From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In December, a lot of observers were caught off guard by President Obama's announcement that the U.S. was beginning a process of normalizing relations with Cuba. The five-decade-old embargo is still in place, but the administration said they were moving to restore diplomatic relations and ease up on travel and trade restrictions. The scholar Patrick Haney says, don't expect Cuba to look like Las Vegas overnight. There are still significant obstacles to repairing the tension in that relationship, but things are changing, like the politics surrounding it. Haney says the Cuban issue is always evolving, in fact. He says it's never been a straight line or a settled policy. Today in the program, we're talking about the history of relations between the U.S. and Cuba, and we invite you to join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The relationship between the U.S. and Cuba has been one of the most fraught in the country's history. For decades, there's been one political reality that has kept the policy fairly static. There's an economic embargo, of course. A diplomatic cold shoulder was in place. But it's important to say, amidst this mistrust and tension, things have evolved and changed. In December, the Obama administration moved to normalize relations with Cuba. The White House said it was reestablishing diplomatic relations, easing up on certain travel and trade restrictions. And the announcement came after a year and a half of secret negotiations. It involved the release of a U.S. aid contractor, Alan Gross, and an American intelligence agent. All of this raises some questions that we're going to get at today, questions like how the politics around Cuba have changed. Questions about whether the embargo and the economic sanctions have actually worked. At the heart of all of this, of course, is whether President Obama's announcement will really heal the relationship with Cuba. You can join us today if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We should point out today's show is a partnership with the Hinckley Institute of Politics. They're having their annual Siciliano Forum this year. They're talking about the future of U.S.-Latin American relations. Tomorrow at noon, there's going to be a discussion about U.S.-Cuban relations at the Hinckley Institute, and we'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. Joining us first today is Patrick Haney. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Miami University, Ohio. Along with Walt Vanderbush, he's the co-author of a book called Cuban Embargo, The Domestic Politics of an American Foreign Policy. And Professor Haney's joining us today from his office in Oxford, Ohio. Patrick Haney, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
I guess I wanted to begin with something that you've been writing about. You make an argument in your book that the policy, the U.S. policy toward Cuba is unique, of course, in many ways, but it has some distinct characteristics. But you say it also shares similarities to other cases. And this seems like an important point to you, that it's not just unique, this relationship. Would you say something about that first?
Well, one of the things about U.S. policy toward Cuba that I think people tend to get locked onto is that it seems so special, such a special case. And I mean, it is a special case. It's, you know, 90 miles off the shore from Florida, and you know, our histories are linked through a variety of, especially in the Cold War, you know, key crises like the Bay of Pigs invasion and the Cuban Missile Crisis. But I do tend to think that the politics that surround that policymaking process is not entirely unique. I think it may be extreme, right, but I don't think it's totally unique. And so a couple things I'd point out about that. One is that the embargo policy was embedded in the sort of strength that the American presidency took on in the heart of the Cold War, that a president could sort of unilaterally declare that our policy toward a particular country was. And the embargo, as people kind of came to know it, mostly existed by presidential order, not with there were legislative components of it, but and that's not unique to Cuba. When we enter the 1980s, we start to see a really aggressive sort of ethnic interest group lobbying around Cuba policy, mostly to strengthen the embargo. And again, while that's probably unique in the Cuba case, it's certainly not the only case like that. We see that with respect to a lot of folks in the United States who lobby on behalf of their homeland. Now, often folks are lobbying in order to try to send, you know, aid back to their homeland. In this case, the folks were mostly lobbying to try to make things harder on their homeland, by and large, by strengthening the embargo. So that ethnic interest group lobbying and the Cuban American National Foundation, in particular, in the 1980s, strikes people as really unique. But I'm not sure it is when you think about things like AIPAC or you think about the NRA. I mean, there's a lot of groups like that that lobby on foreign policy. And then the other element that entered in, especially as you head into the 1990s, is the strong hand that individual members of Congress and Congress as an institution started to take in shaping the policy. And that's not unique either. And in some ways, it links back to where we started with the vision of the framers, where Congress as the legislative body was sort of setting the course for policy. So I think there are a lot of elements of Cuba policy that are special, that are extreme, that I think are fascinating, but I don't think they're entirely unique.
It is so interesting to see that a lot of this, the relationship between Cuba and the United States, has gone back and forth in connection to the relationship between Congress, as you say. It seems like it's about power between Congress and the president. I mean, one of the insights of your book, which is really interesting, is how the war in Vietnam and Watergate, for that matter, had an effect on Cuba policy. Because you say after Vietnam and the scandal of Watergate, presidents, in particular, I suppose, Ronald Reagan, they wanted to regain some of the ground they had lost to Congress. Say something about that.
Well, I think that we often, especially now when the storyline that's so common when we're focusing on the dynamics of American politics is one of partisanship and Republicans versus Democrats, we forget that there's another story, and that's the different branches of government, these three branches of government that share a body of powers. And Congress and the president were both given significant dose of power by the framers, and the framers were obviously skeptical about the emergence of another king, and so a lot of the powers that the president got were checked powers, and so throughout our history we've seen a bit of a tug and pull between the branches about who's sort of control of foreign policy. In the heart of the Cold War, presidents were by and large carrying the day on that, but I think that this combination, in some ways, it's sort of the three pillars that transformed a lot of American politics: Vietnam, Watergate, and civil rights. Mm-hmm. You put those two movements together and run that through the 60s and into the early 70s, and you not only have a transformation of American society, but of the institution of Congress, too. You had a lot of new members of Congress come to Washington. They didn't want to wait 30 years to have some power. And the only way you'd have power would be to be the head of a committee. So one of the things Congress did in the 70s was to say, well, we should start having subcommittees of committees and have a lot of subcommittees of committees. And the next thing you know, you have a lot of chairs of subcommittees. And so now you have a lot of little fiefdoms and a lot of ways for individual members of Congress very quickly to get their hands on policy and try and push it and promote it. There's this great quote that I think that Walt and I have in the book, after Dick Armey from Texas had retired from a long career, and he said something along the lines of, there are a lot of votes that you care strongly about, and then there are a lot of votes that you're really not sure, what you think about, and so you look for cues from members who you respect and who do feel strongly about it, and you vote along with them. You like them, you care about them, you respect them, and for him, he said, Cuba policy was one of those things. He'd see these members that he respected and they cared very strongly about it. So he'd go with them. And a lot of times, especially in the as we headed into the 90s, the members in Congress started to have a very different view of Cuba policy than some presidents did. And so the story of Cuba policy is one that shifts not only in terms of how, you know, some imaginary wizard who thinks about what our foreign policy should be might, you know, who the new wizard is, who the new president is, or you know, some foreign policy analyst saying what policy should be. But it shifts based on who's in Congress and what do they think and what's the relationship between Congress and the president. So that's part of what makes it what makes it so fun to track, too.
It seems like one of these shifts was, so you had in the Kennedy and partially the Eisenhower administration, you know, you write about the fact that in those eras, the president and his advisors were making Cuba policy mostly out of public view, as you said. There wasn't a lot, or much anyway, in the way of domestic political pressure early on. They were just saying, hey, I'm the president, here's how we're going to deal with Cuba. And then that evolves. And when Congress starts to get interested in all of this, when there starts to be domestic political pressure and interest in all of this, it seems like it's a shift from we're worried about national security, about the security of this little island 90 miles away, and it started to become more about human rights, and it started to become more about economics. Does that about get at it?
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, there are lots of, I mean, I love the phrase you used there earlier about, you know, how do you heal the relationship? But this is a really complex relationship, and it's got lots and lots of elements to it. And those elements also have sort of, you know, risen and fallen a little bit in terms of prominence. When you have something like the Cuban Revolution and in the heart of the Cold War, you know, and you have the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, it's not unreasonable to think about security concerns. And even in 1970, there was a sort of mini security crisis that broke out with the Soviets in Cuba over a submarine base. But I think you're right. Over time, the primary focus started to shift a bit away from the security focus, although I think Cuba is still today on the list of terrorist sponsoring countries, and toward things that are less, you know, in wonky terms, they're less interest than they are ideals, like democracy and human rights. And in this 1970s, when the American public was really calling for foreign policy that cared more about human rights, and in some sense, you know, helped contribute to the emergence of Jimmy Carter and the Carter presidency, you start to see those sort of ideals come into the lexicon. The language of Ronald Reagan about freedom and liberty and democracy and self-governance would start to, you know, focus on those. But even in the 1980s, I mean, there was a sense that much of the revolutionary activity in Latin America, you know, was essentially being funneled from Moscow through Havana and into Managua and then out. And so there's still these security concerns there. And boy, certainly after the Cold War ended, and that was really in some ways the most fascinating period, because you have this whole sort of relationship, or not all of it, but a large part of it premised about, you know, it's the Soviet stooge in the hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore, so which way do you go? And there was sort of a brief period there where people took stock and tried to decide which way to go. But the decision pretty clearly was made by the Bush administration, and then the Clinton administration and the Clinton campaign sort of doubled down on the idea that, well, you don't let up now, so we'll go ahead and keep our foot on the throat.
It seems like a lot of the power related to the Cuba question settled in Congress for a while. You say that for decades, any significant changes on Cuba policy would have to go through Congress, but then of course comes December of 2014, last December, when the Obama administration makes this, you know, remarkable pronouncement about trying to normalize relationships, the relationship with Cuba. How is that changing the power dynamic? Is the power, at least for a time, shifting back to now the executive branch?
Well, it really is a fascinating part of the story. I mean, so let me back up to something I said early on, that most of the embargo of Cuba, and sort of start by thinking about the embargo not as a single item, but actually as lots of different components. They include mechanisms about who can travel and when and under what circumstances and how much money they can spend, how much money you can send to family, what we call remittances,
right.
You know, what you can sell to Cuba, what you can import from Cuba, what kinds of financial transactions happen. I mean, there's all kinds of these things that are part of the mix. And each of them have, you know, sometimes gotten harder and sometimes gotten weaker, and sometimes one gets harder and the other gets weaker. So the embargo itself is really quite multifaceted. And but over time, most of those things have been levers, or you think about them as dials on a stereo set, maybe. You know, they've been dials that the president really, through presidential orders to the Treasury Department, who manages sanctions regimes, would say, look, I want to actually make it harder for people to travel to Cuba, and I'm going to institute a travel ban. In 1963, we instituted a ban on travel to Cuba. In 1977, Carter dropped it. 1982, Reagan put it back on. You know, so you kind of change that dial a little bit. Those dials were mostly in control of the president. And one of the things that happened in the Clinton administration in 1995 was these two aircraft flown by a group in Cuba,
mm-hmm.
Called Brothers to the Rescue, were shot down over the Straits of Florida by Cuban Air Force fighters. And that led to a very impressive legislative reaction. There had been a bill that was floating around in Congress named after Dan Burton from Republican at the time from Indiana in the House, and Jesse Helms in the Senate, called Helms, that would have tightened the sanctions regime on Cuba. But it was pretty well stripped out, the sort of elements that a president who wants to control policy might not like Congress legislating about. But that shoot down brought all those elements back in, and it introduced a new element. The very first part of that bill is what's called codification. It wrote into law all the federal regs about the Cuban embargo as of that day. Boom, got locked into law. And so now, I mean, if you want to drop the embargo, you know, think about in the Clinton administration, for example, we normalized relations with Vietnam. He just did it because right. All that stuff existed as a presidential order anyway, and so he changed the order. But now you can't do that. You'd have to run it through Congress. But, and this is the really interesting part, I think, you know, it's sort of, if you watch Animal House, sort of the little-known codicil to the Faber College Constitution was the president had some ability to work around remittances and family travel. And since that time, first Clinton, to some extent Bush, although he was mostly tightening, and then Obama for sure, has used that little tiny crack in the idea that this is now actually all Congress's domain and blown that door wide open. And so they've used that sort of entry point to say, well, if I can tinker with this, I can tinker with all these other things. The embargo still stands. But, I mean, if you look at it, the new rules allow just about every kind of travel except tourism, right? So there's still not a tourism free-for-all. Actually, you can import things from Cuba now, but it can't be a government business. It's got to be a sort of sole entrepreneur that makes a product. And not all products, but certain products you could import and purchase from Cuba. So, you know, that what looked like a very small window for the president to alter policy in 1996, first Clinton and now very dramatically with Obama, presidents have found ways to get their hands back on that policy. And I think it's got Congress in sort of an interesting spot right now as they're trying to figure out, you know, if we even wanted to try to restrain what Obama's doing, how do we do it? What mechanism do we have, perhaps short of impeachment, to even try to get our hands back on this thing, other than the sort of ultimate question of the embargo itself. Mm-hmm. So it's a fascinating development.
Patrick Haney is with us, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Miami University, Ohio. Along with Walt Vanderbush, he is the co-author of the book Cuban Embargo, The Domestic Politics of an American Foreign Policy. He's joining us from his office in Oxford, Ohio. We invite you to join us if you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. All this week, we've been following the Hinckley Institute of Politics Forum on U.S.-Latin American relations. One of those subjects in the forum is the relationship between the United States and Cuba. Tomorrow at noon, there's going to be a discussion about U.S.-Cuban relations at the Hinckley Institute. It's part of the forum. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. You can go to our website, by the way, for that, radiowest.kuer.org. Today in the program, we're talking about that relationship, that often tense, always tense probably, relationship between the U.S. and Cuba. We've had with us Patrick Haney, professor of political science at Miami University, Ohio. Joining us now on the program is Paolo Spadoni. He's an assistant professor of political science at Georgia Regents University. That's in Augusta, Georgia. He's the author of a book called Failed Sanctions, Why the U.S. Embargo Against Cuba Could Never Work. And he's joining us today from a studio in Gainesville, Florida. That's where he's based. And Professor Spadoni, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I guess I wanted to start with, maybe we should talk about that transitional moment you write about beginning in the early 90s, that for a while in this relationship, many years anyway, Cuba was able to weather the storm, the sanctions, the embargo, because of the Cold War. They had these subsidies that they got from the former Soviet Union, cheap oil, those kinds of things. But beginning in the 90s, when the Cold War started to go away, that special relationship ended and Cuba became more vulnerable. And this is the moment that you write about. This was the true test. If you take the Soviet Union out of the equation, these sanctions now should work. But it didn't really work out that way. Talk about that broadly. This was the real test, I guess, for the U.S. in that relationship.
Sure. The early 90s was a very different period than the Cold War period. Patrick explained very well the main features and dynamics of U.S. policy toward Cuba. I would argue that the post-1990 period is a much more unique period than the Cold War, meaning that during the Cold War, the United States was reacting to what Cuba was doing, and the rationale for the embargo made sense, considering that Cuba was siding itself with the Soviet Union, had expropriated U.S. properties, was trying to actively export the revolution across Latin America, and so forth. The post-1990 period is really a period during which the United States tried to get the most of the economic sanctions that had failed for over three decades to produce changes in Cuba. And the way they did it, it was to squeeze economically the Castro government with a new wave of sanctions. Mm-hmm. The interesting part about that is that the sanctions had very little to do with what was happening in Cuba, meaning that Cuba was sort of introducing reforms, free market reforms in the early 90s, and the United States at the same time was squeezing economically Cuba. The whole point where we argue still today, if the embargo is there to produce change in Cuba, to contain Cuba in some ways, as some scholars have mentioned, the real point is really to squeeze economically the government by denying her currency revenues. So in that sense, that's the biggest failure of sanctions, because despite all the attempts on the part of the United States to exercise pressure, economic pressure on Cuba, lots of capital have been flowing hard currency from the United States to Cuba in a variety of ways. So my book, what it's talking about is all the different ways through which the United States, despite the purpose of the embargo, has been propping up the Cuban government during the 90s and then in the 2000s.
Let's talk a little bit about some of those factors that that made it so these sanctions, this embargo, didn't really work the way the United States thought it was. You write about what you call these transnational actors. You've got corporations, multinational corporations. You've got migrants, you've got travelers, you've got family members who are sending remittances. All of these things are in play, so there's all kinds of money flowing into Cuba, I guess.
Absolutely. Only on the issue of remittances, leaving aside the Venezuela factor that has become more of a factor in the past few years, especially since Chavez came to power in Venezuela and then unfortunately passed away. But remittances has always been in terms the biggest hard currency revenues for the Cuban government, at least since the late 90s. So sometimes we think that tourism is the most important generator of a currency for Cuba. Remittances in net terms have been way more important. So we have several actors playing a role, U.S. visitors, including Cuban Americans. You have remittances. One thing to consider is that the migrants in the post-1990 period, the migrants to the United States have kept very close connection with Cuba. And of course, since remittances were legalized in 1994, lots of money had been flowing from the United States to Cuba. And considering in Cuba, there are no hard currency private stores, so all the money in some way ends up in the coffers of the Cuban government. And then you have another interesting aspect, which is telecommunication payments. Throughout, over the past 15 years, the United States has been paying every year the Cuban government a significant amount of money for telecommunication services. And the other part is that very few people know that there's a lot of U.S. indirect investments in Cuba. We sometimes think that everything done from the U.S. side is prohibited in terms of investment in Cuba. If you look at the most important corporations, third country-based corporations invested in Cuba, there is a lot of U.S. capital in all of those corporations. So if we put all together, the whole purpose of trying to squeeze economically the government has not worked. And I think in a way the Obama administration has finally recognized that the old policy did not work and we should try a different approach. Mm. One thing that I also want to add, finally the United States has a sort of proactive policy on Cuba. I would argue that many years the United States has no real policy on Cuba. So domestic politics played a role in the United States, but it was really not connected to what was happening in Cuba. Finally, we do have a proactive policy, even though it still remains to be seen whether it will produce the changes the United States would like to see on the ground in Cuba.
You argue in your book, though, that even if you don't exactly get what you want with economic sanctions, even if they don't exactly produce what you're hoping for, that they can be worthwhile, maybe even useful. What do you mean by that?
Sometimes might be just to stand in favor of your own principles and not giving up in rewarding a country with which you have promised. So that could be a point. But in general, sometimes you might have an issue of containment, so to prevent the country to do even more things that they are planning to do. In the case of Cuba, I don't think that really applies in the sense that what is happening in Cuba and what is happening right now, it's really what the Cuban government wants. We, the United States, has to understand that U.S. policy can be influential on Cuba, but cannot really produce the kind of changes it wants unless the Cuban government and the Cuban people want them to happen.
Right. So that has to be, I think you point this out in your book too, if something's going to change, it has to be internal within Cuba, not necessarily the United States.
Absolutely. And for the longest time, this policy of isolation, which has put, ironically, the United States more isolated than Cuba, I would say, considering how many other countries felt about the U.S. embargo, has actually strengthened the Cuban government, providing a scapegoat for all the shortcomings of their own policies. So now, finally, you have a policy that will sort of take out, to a certain extent, that aspect from Cuba policy and would highlight some of the shortcomings that the Cuban government has to face and some of the things they have to do in order to address their own problems.
You mentioned something that President George W. Bush said about the economic sanctions in Cuba. And this is interesting. The president said that these sanctions and this embargo, that these aren't just policies, but it's a moral statement, he said, that it's wrong to prop up a regime that stifles human freedom. Would you talk a little bit more about that? That for a long time, as we were talking about with Patrick Haney before, the shift came away from national security and security issues to economics and, I suppose, in this case, the question of human rights. What does President Bush's statement tell you about that?
I do fully understand that for some people, the moral issue when it comes to Cuba is an important one. And the issue of human rights, the issue of an organized political opposition in Cuba being liberalized, all those things are very important. However, if you do implement your policy based on principle, then you also have to compare Cuba with other countries whose human rights record is also questionable, and seeing why the principle there does not apply and why it applies only to Cuba. Let me put things in perspective. Cuba has one of the most comprehensive embargo in place among all countries. Okay, so the travel ban on Cuba, which took the right of Americans to travel to Cuba and actually to spend money in Cuba for unlicensed purposes, it only refers to Cuba and not to other countries. You can travel to Iran, you can travel to many other countries with a very questionable human rights record. So if you work on principle and if you stand by principle, then you have to have a consistent policy. So then Cuba is no longer an exception, should be treated like all the other countries. So to me, the issue of human rights is an understandable issue, but you have to be consistent if you do abide by the principle. Otherwise, you have to recognize that Cuba most likely does not belong to the list of terrorist countries anymore. If you look at the list, you have Sudan, you have Iran, you had Syria, and you have also have Cuba. So you may wonder why Cuba is on the list, why is Cuba treated that way. So even though I understand the human rights issues, we also have to produce a policy that will lead Cuba toward a different kind of system, and those human rights along the road will eventually be addressed and improved.
Let me ask you, one of the things we were talking about with Professor Haney earlier was the what the Obama administration's announcement in December means in this story. It's the latest development in a constantly evolving case. But what do you make about the significance of what President Obama did in December?
I do think it's really significant. Even though I have to qualify what the Obama administration has done, there are two big moments when it comes to Cuba since Obama became president in January 2009. First, in April 2009, and then the regulation were put into law in September of that year, the Obama administration liberalized travel and remittances to Cuba by Cuban Americans. So that was the first step, because Obama in 2004 had spoken against the embargo, and then by the time he was running for president, as others have done in the past, sort of changed his position by saying that the embargo was an important leveraging tool to extract concessions from the part of Cuba. Now, what happened in 2009 is that, at least in my view, is that the Obama administration sort of eliminated the Cuban issue for a while by allowing the new wave of migrants to travel back to Cuba to send money, and still having the old migrants rallying behind the embargo. So for a few years, you didn't really see so much movement in Congress and on the part of the White House about Cuba. Now you have this wind of the last 2 years before Obama will leave office. And now you have this bold move that finally was long overdue, that the Obama administration decided to move toward normalization increase some travel and trade with Cuba. Now, let me be clear also about that part. The process will not be an easy one. There may be several obstacles down the road, also considering that the day after Obama and Raul Castro made that announcement at the same time, then Raul Castro went on television again and said, our system is non-negotiable. We don't really like the meddling of the United States into our internal affairs, their dealings with political dissidents, and we don't like to be on the list of terrorist countries. So what I'm saying is that even though the action of the Obama administration has been quite positive and significant, still remains to be seen what will happen down the road in terms of improving really the relationship, and also consider that we're going to have a presidential election less than 2 years away, and you might have a new president and eventually a Republican president that can undo all the things that Obama just did.
Brings us back around to this political question, of course, and when we get back from a break, I want to talk about political will, the effect of Cuban Americans, which have played such a role in this story over the years. It'll be interesting to see how that may be shifting. We have with us Paolo Spadoni, an assistant professor of political science at Georgia Regents University. When we get back from a break, we'll bring Patrick Haney back into the conversation. The program today is part of our partnership with the Hinckley Institute of Politics. Their Siciliano Forum on the Future of U.S.-Latin American Relations is taking place this week. Tomorrow at noon, there's going to be a discussion about U.S.-Cuban relations at the Hinckley Institute on the campus, the university. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For more than 50 years, the United States has maintained economic sanctions against Cuba. But as you know, things are changing. They're always changing in that relationship. President Obama is trying to reestablish a formal relationship with Cuba. Today in the program, we're examining the tense history of that relationship, asking just how well the economic embargo has worked, what is changing, and whether you can repair that relationship. Patrick Haney, back with us, a professor of political science at Miami University, Ohio, joining us from an office in Oxford, Ohio. And Paolo Spadoni is an assistant professor of political science at Georgia Regents University. He's with us. Paolo Spadoni, can I get you to comment maybe on the changing nature of the exile community? That seems to be a big question here, if I understand it right. There's a shift going on among Cuban Americans.
Sure. Domestic politics has always played a very important role in U.S. policy toward Cuba, especially since the late 80s. If we consider what happened in the case of U.S. policy toward Cuba in the post-Cold War period, all major changes happening in an election, presidential election year, at least until 2008. So, for instance, in 92, President Bush, George H. Bush, at that time, he really spoke against that he didn't like the Torricelli Law, the Cuban Democracy Act is also known, that was passed in 1992 as a new wave of sanctions against Cuba. Then candidate Clinton embraced the law, and then President Bush also said he liked it as well. In 96, you have the Helms-Burton Law. In 2000, you have a change in a law that will allow U.S. food sales to Cuba. And in 2004, you have a new wave of tightening. The one of 2000 is very interesting because at that time, Clinton was not up for re-election. So obviously, he had some leverage when he came to Cuba. So what I'm saying is that every single presidential election year, something big on Cuba happened. It does show you how the importance of domestic politics is when it comes to Cuba. So in that sense, it still is today. That is true still today, even though the community has been changing. The new wave of migrants post-1990 has been a different kind of migrants, more resembling the people that come from other countries migrating to the United States in search of better economic opportunities. The problem with U.S. policy toward Cuba is that those who are influential in determining the nature of the policy, and I'm referring to Cuban American legislators, do not really reflect as they used to the community at large. So what I'm saying, the community is pretty much split. There are the new wave of migrants who like to have connection with Cuba, like to normalize relations with Cuba, and then you have the old wave of migrants and their representative in Congress still opposing any sort of opening when it comes to Cuba.
Patrick Haney, I want to get your comments on this political dimension. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I heard the last part there from Pablo. I think that one of the things that's really interesting is that, and I totally agree with the idea that, and I don't think it's just by accident that something about Cuba pops up every time there's an election.
Right.
But, you know, these last couple of elections were interesting because Obama was able to win Florida without, you know, full on jumping to the hard line of the embargo. When Bill Clinton ran for president against George Herbert Walker Bush, it was in that period where the Cold War had just ended, and Clinton went to Miami and he said, "I've read the Cuban Democracy Act and I like it." Right. And, you know, their view was that they liked the politics of that. They sort of outflanked Bush on his right a little bit. And they thought that they liked the policy too, which was sort of, you know, hard on the regime and soft on the people. But that certainly helped to break up what had become a really solid core of Republican voters among the Cuban Americans in Florida, which at that time made up a big, you know, substantial chunk of the Hispanic votes in Florida. Now, Clinton didn't win Florida in 92, but they did win in 96.
96, yeah.
And, you know, the Gore in Florida in 2000, of course, is something that we make movies about now. So, you know, it put the community in play in ways that it hadn't been in quite some time. And over time then, as Pablo noted, the community itself has been changing, generational changes, you know, new ideas about policy. But also the migration patterns in Florida have changed. And so Cuban American voters are a distinct minority now of Hispanic voters in Florida. And so, you know, Obama can do much better in Florida, was able to do much better in Florida without really tacking over to where the hardliners were on the embargo. As a result, he wasn't beholden to the embargo as president. And while he gave that lip service that Pablo mentioned to say, well, the embargo is important, you know, he started easing the elements on it as soon as he got into the White House. I think they wanted to go farther faster, but the sense was they weren't getting anything back from Cuba. And what's the percentage in keeping your foot on that gas pedal when people keep thinking, although they've been saying this for decades now, that the Castros were going to pass from the scene? But, you know, once again, people were starting to talk that in the second administration, Obama would try to move toward normalization. One thing, not to belabor the point, that I think is really curious about that is we'd heard the same things about the Clinton administration, that in the second term they were going to want to normalize relations with Cuba the same way they had with Vietnam. And I do think there was a hope that following a Pope's visit to Cuba and a call for Cuba to respect human rights and the U.S. to drop the embargo, in this case John Paul II, that Clinton might ride that wave a little bit. The same weekend John Paul arrived in Cuba was the weekend that the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke. And so that's another element. You know, I mean, you can have this plan for where a policy might go, but boy, there's all kinds of other elements that can get into the picture. But it is interesting that once again, a Pope played a very significant factor, in this case, Pope Francis, in helping to move these things along. These are these transnational elements that Pablo talks about in his book, too. So it's great. It's more than just Florida, but Florida is a really key piece of the puzzle.
Patrick Haney, what do you think about Paolo Spadoni's been talking about the fact that there's this biological clock in play here? Now you have the most recent migrants, more working class, more interested in, you know, decent relationships between the two countries because of their families, and maybe that's the dimension that's almost entirely unique here that President Clinton didn't have to really deal with because, you know, the anti-Castro faction in Miami was pretty vibrant. Just they were alive. They were engaged at that time. They're frankly dying off at this point, and that seems to be shifting things.
And even a lot of their views are altering too. But yeah, second and now heading toward third generation Cuban Americans, you know, tend to see the Cuba issue in a broader perspective. And we can overdo these things. And I've heard people say they're not crazy about the polling that's done there. But it certainly looks like you've got, you know, roughly a 50-50 split or a majority of even Cuban Americans who think we ought to be having more dialogue. We ought to be doing more toward normalizing relations. And, you know, if that's plus or minus 5 points, it's still a huge difference from where it was 20 years ago. So it's a very different political environment in Florida for Obama. But as Pablo raises, who knows what this next election cycle will bring.
Right.
But I don't think that the hardcore of the embargo has the kind of juice to it politically that it had even 10 years ago, certainly not 15 years ago.
I want to get both of you on this question that Paolo Spadoni raised a little bit earlier, and this question about what we know about Cuban culture. You know, is anti-American sentiment now baked into the Cuban culture? And what do we know about whether or not this move by the Obama administration is going to, are they going to welcome it? I mean, clearly in some cases they will, but isn't there this inclination for it to repel something like this too? Paolo Spadoni, you first.
On the issue of anti-American sentiment in Cuba, I've been traveling to Cuba for several years, and really that was never the case. Even during the time of the Bush administration, strengthening the grip on Cuba was never the case on the ground. So in that sense, I would say I don't see any difference now. The Cubans welcome the Obama changes very much, and they like them. One thing that happens is that during the time of Fidel Castro in power in Cuba, there were a lot of demonstrations and protests against U.S. imperialism. Even that aspect during the Raul Castro tenure has certainly subsided, and now they're focusing more on what they have to do and not what the United States is doing when it comes to Cuba. So in that sense, I would say there's a different period also in Cuba. One last thing that I have to say about the issue of the embargo. Yes, it's true, as Patrick said, the community is 50-50. But now, when it comes to the embargo, at best we have a 50-50 between the White House and Congress. Because if you look at all the Cuban Americans in Congress, they all tend to oppose any opening with Cuba. There was one Congress member, Joe Garcia, won in 2012. He lost his seat in 2014, not only because of the Cuban issue, but he had at least taken a stance of a more proactive and open approach on Cuba. So what I'm saying is that it's a 50-50 right now, but if there's a new Republican president, it can become again an 80-20 or even worse.
Patrick Haney, you seem to wonder if Cuba will respond in the ways we want. What do you mean by that?
Well, we're talking about Cuba as if it were a single item too, you know, and it's got lots of different elements inside it.
Yeah.
But I think this is one of these sorts of negotiating kind of moments where, you know, one side takes a step and then you see how the other one responds. And, you know, I think if the regime somehow, you know, for example, to feel threatened and go and lock up a bunch of political prisoners, you know, that could alter the game plan for these things. So I think, you know, I just don't know what all will happen. But I presume that over time, you know, in the long run, this is going to head toward normal relations. You know, another thing I would say too about Paolo's comment about the embargo hardliners in Congress, it's also interesting who the strongest opponents of the hard line of the embargo are. It used to be that it was primarily the Democratic left, and it still is a lot of that. But there's a lot of the Republican sort of business interest and libertarian right that isn't crazy about this stuff. I loved how Paolo said it. You know, the travel ban is a restriction on your liberty to travel to Cuba. You can travel all kinds of places, but you can't travel to Cuba. And so even in Utah, for example, Representative Chaffetz is sort of more on the side like Jeff Flake in Arizona and some others that were, you know, not sold on the idea that this kind of an embargo ought to be happening. We ought to let markets and we ought to let liberty work these things out. So, I think he's certainly right about where the Cuban Americans in Congress are, and I totally agree with him about the dynamic. But it's just sort of interesting that, you know, it's not like it's a Democratic versus Republican issue in Congress. It's more complicated.
Do you think along that line that that Marco Rubio, Senator Rubio, was surprised by that kind of reaction? I think it would be fair to say he probably expected to get a little bit more traction responding negatively to the president's move in December, but it doesn't seem like that's happened. And I wonder if he's surprised by that and if it will have a significant impact on his efforts to run for president, in fact.
He may be surprised by it, but I also think that, you know, politicians speak to different kinds of publics.
Yeah.
And my guess is he got exactly the right response that he wanted from the public that he cared about. And that's both his re-election constituency, the people that actually cast ballots, but also a fundraising constituency and how he positions himself as a national figure relative to who he's going to raise money from. There's a lot of people he's never going to raise money from, he's never going to get votes from. So whatever he says about Cuba doesn't matter.
Right.
You know, the elections are often about, you know, the strength of a small group than, you know, the strength of a broad-based sort of agreement. So it may be that he wasn't surprised at all. He knew he was speaking primarily to a small segment, both in terms of votes and also in terms of fundraising.
Let me ask, we've got a few minutes left. I wanted to get to the question of the Castro brothers now. What happens when they die? Sounds awfully crass, I guess, to put it that way. But Paolo Spadoni, what do you think? I mean, what happens when you have those charismatic forces out of the way. How does that change the dynamic?
Well, the biological clock cannot be avoided. So in the case of both Castro's, time is limited. In the case of Fidel Castro, he left power for good in 2006, even though there was a transition period until 2008 when his brother became officially president. But even in the case of Raul Castro, he has already made a commitment to step down in 2018 by limiting all public officials in Cuba to only two five-year terms in office. So by 2018, Raul Castro will no longer be the president of Cuba. Now you have a new, relatively young vice president in Cuba that will eventually take over the country at that time, but still all the political dynamics are uncertain. What we missed clear is that the biological clock is ticking, and by 2018, a Castro will not be ruling Cuba. So all the rest remains to be seen, but I think at the same time that U.S. policy is evolving, also the political landscape in Cuba is evolving as well.
Patrick Haney, final word?
Well, he's right that it can't be avoided, but boy, it sure has been elongated. So I wouldn't count I wouldn't count these guys out. I mean, in the 90s, Jesse Helms was saying he didn't care if Fidel Castro left horizontal or vertical, only that he left. And, you know, they're still kicking. But I do tend to think we're going to see transition. We do see transition. We're also going to see difference of opinion inside of Cuba about what a Cuban reality, a Cuban existence that's more closely in partnership with the U.S. is going to look like. And that's sort of what I meant, that I would not expect this to just turn into Vegas overnight. I think there's going to want to be a Cuban way to go, even when the Castros are gone.
Patrick Haney, professor of political science at Miami University, Ohio, co-author of the book Cuban Embargo, The Domestic Politics of an American Foreign Policy. Professor Haney, thanks for the time today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
And Paolo Spadoni, an assistant professor of political science at Georgia Regents University, author of the book Failed Sanctions, Why the U.S. Embargo Against Cuba Could Never Work. Thanks to you, Professor.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
We should mention, as part of our focus on U.S. Latin American issues this week, we're featuring two films that fit in with that theme on Video West. Go to videowest.kuer.org to watch them both. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. Our thanks to Braden Child. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.